We're back with the Paula Gordon Show. Dr. Ricky Ott is our guest. Bill Russell, you are looking so eager. Let's give you the chance.
Well, I reading your book and you know, just starting from the, you know, the event itself, the Exxon Valdez, I continue to think that Americans and maybe other people in the world suffer from an acute case of attention deficit disorder. You know, there's an out of sight, out of mind condition, which I think is pretty much characteristic. But we simply do not look backwards. We do not seem to remember. There seems to be no institutional memory in the medical community, in the governmental community, and in the body politic.
Well, and we have a lot of young viewers and young people who listeners. It is important to say we're talking in the year 2005. The Exxon Valdez spill was in 1989. And there are a lot of young people who simply weren't awake or maybe born when this happened. So please start with that. In 1989, March,
the Exxon Valdez grounded in Prince William Sound. And
what
spilled.
Is it?
What is the Exxon Valdez? It's a supertanker. It was almost 1,000 feet long, standard super tanker size, and it was a young tanker, 3 years old only, in pretty still top shape. And there was a skipper at the helm who, it's debated still whether or not he was actually drunk at the time, but what is not debated is that he did not have his driver's license for driving while intoxicated, yet he was behind the helm of this super tanker. So we have a tanker on the rocks, and that tanker spilled, according to Exxon, 11 million gallons of oil. Now, I subsequently heard when I was in Valdez on day one of this spill that there was a high-end estimate as well, which was 38 million gallons. And I never forgot that figure. When I started doing research for this book, I discovered the state of Alaska had actually conducted a secret investigation in preparation for a lawsuit that was never filed, that surveyors in that were part of the state's investigation both identified or measured the spill volume at 30 to 35 million gallons. So I pretty much realized right on day one that the corporate mindset was going to try to understate and minimize this spill. So again, I better pay attention. And some of the first things that were brought to my attention were the early spill responders, the commercial fishermen. Of course, we're right there on the grounds. We had our boats. We were ready to do something to defend our basically our immediate backyard.
Well, and please describe that backyard.
And your livelihood.
Okay. And you were a fisherman at that point.
Goodness. There's a lot of background here.
Yes, there is.
Okay.
And talk about Prince William Sound. This is a nice name, but what is this thing?
Okay, so we're going to hold on the early spill responders and catch everybody up here to how I arrived in Prince William Sound. And what had happened was...
No, I want to hear about the sound. I want to hear
the
about
sound.
This beautiful place.
We're going to get there because that's why I ended up there. I had finished a master's and a doctorate in oil pollution, and that was 13 years of work on the East Coast and the West Coast, and I thought, all right, I deserve some time off, come on, before I start a career. So I had always wanted to go to Alaska, and it was just a hop, skip, and a jump away from Seattle, so up I went, and what's a marine biologist to do? So I got a job crewing on a salmon boat, and it just happened to be in Prince William Sound. So I saw the area first from the water. I mean, we came in on this boat, and I totally fell in love. It's like Switzerland, a marine Switzerland, because you have these immense tidewater glaciers that come right down to the sea. And in May, when we start commercial fishing, the air is just alive with seabirds, puffins, ducks, waterfowl, just starting their summer breeding routine. The water, you see little brown heads bobbing all over the place, harbor seals, porpoise, sea lions, sea otters, rafts and rafts of sea otters, more sea otters than in the entire state of California, just in Prince William Sound alone. And everything's crying and mewing and chirping, and I mean, it's just an alive place. Whales, pods of killer whales cruise up and down these inlets, either hunting fish or marine mammals. There's two different types of killer whales, and it's like fishing in a zoo. It really is. And we have these, I I fished for 1 year and thought, you know, I can do this. And I bought into the commercial fishery, and it's a limited entry permit, like a liquor license, so it's a one-time big amount of money. And I was fishing with a friend, Danny, and we had this little drift gillnet boat about 28 feet long, and a drift gillnet. Now, the drift gillnet was 3 football fields long and about, 30 feet deep or so, and we tend it constantly. It's never left out for more than a couple hours at a time, and
so
we're always monitoring it.
So this isn't like those great big dragnet things.
Exactly. That's my point. This is a very targeted fishery. You're targeted on the salmon, and there's extraordinary little bycatch. And I was raised as an environmentalist, although we did not use that word. We just wore it in practice. I mean, my father sued the state of Wisconsin over the use of DDT. Wisconsin was the first state to ban DDT. My father was Aldo Leopold's last student, final classes. So, and I was impressed that this fishery had a strong following, because the community of Cordova, where I eventually wound up, over half of the town is directly involved in commercial fishing. It's second, third, fourth generation fishermen. They take care of their fishery. That was what really impressed me about the area, because they want this to support their sons and their grandsons, and their daughters too are out there fishing at 12, 13 years old. They have their own boats and permits. So it's a family lifestyle. And I was totally enjoying it. And I had also become involved in the winter with the local fishermen's political organization. And my thinking was, okay, I fish in the summers, and this is a beautiful area, and I want to gift back to the area with my education in the winters. And so I was working on chronic air and water pollution at the Alyeska Tanker Terminal, which is the terminus of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which stretches 800 miles north to the very top of Alaska, the North Slope oil fields. So the oil comes down this enormous pipeline and then is put onto tankers. The tankers go through Prince William Sound, and they mostly service West Coast, but they go other places as well. And there's always this tension between the oil industry and the commercial fishing industry and the starting of the tourist industry, you know, because the one industry has such a huge potential to really put the other two completely out. And that is, of course, what happened on March 24th, 1989. And it was just overwhelming to fly over and see this enormous pool of blue-black oil with these vapors just pouring into the air. And
would it be right to call it catastrophic?
It was. I call it the environmental 9/11, to put it in perspective for young listeners. That was our generation sort of mark. We've really blown it this time. And the thinking, I remember even when this happened, the fishermen in their response and in our despair, some of the fishermen said, you know, if it had to happen in Prince William Sound, which is one of the most beautiful places on earth, then at least let's learn something from this. And that's what I carried with me all through. And that's what actually got me through writing 6 years of writing this book, was we are learning something, and I've got to get this book done.
Well,
I think the science piece of this, the ability to do a longitudinal study is important, particularly given the kinds of chemicals and the biological effects and the environmental effects, and the ability to do an experiment that nobody in their right mind would do, but having done the experiment effectively, might as well learn from it. Both of those seem to be very, very, very important. And on the one hand, things have been learned. On the other hand, it seems an awful lot of what could have been learned hasn't been, and what has been hasn't been applied.
Oops. Okay.
Standard operating procedure. Well, okay, so when I was paying attention back in 1989, two things kind of emerged. One was that the fishermen were getting sick, the early spill responders. They were getting headaches, they were getting sneezy respiratory fits. And they kept saying, you know, aren't we supposed to have some kind of protection out here? And then Exxon started this big cleanup program, and it peak operations in Prince William Sound in the summer of 89, there was actually over 11,000 people out with this high-pressure hot water wash. And that's sort of where the tragedy, another tragedy, began, because the killing actually did not stop with the oil or in 1989. that high pressure hot water wash did two things. Hot water, for starters. What do you do when you want to cook mussels or, you know, have yourself a nice clam dinner? You boil the critters. And so that hot wash basically wiped out the animals that had survived the initial oiling. It was astonishing.
How hot was water?
I have it in my book. I can't remember offhand. Very hot. Very hot. Very hot.
And not boiling, but you wouldn't want to touch it, right?
Actually, yes, that's right. It was too hot to touch. And so it sterilized, not sterilized, but it killed things and laid bare huge swaths of bare rock, which the creatures, it just took longer to recolonize bare rock from nothing. So,
well, it destroys the ecosystem.
It destroyed the ecosystem.
All the little pieces that might restore are just gone.
And the scientists, in hindsight, found that it actually took these beaches that had been treated this way longer to recover than beaches that had been left untreated. And then the second thing is this pressure. What that did was it hit the beaches from fire hoses with such force that it literally bounced the oil into the air and aerosolized a very toxic fraction of oil to human health. And the workers weren't trained to either protect themselves against this. They weren't given respirators, but they also weren't trained to recognize health symptoms.
There's a great deal more to be said about those health symptoms, creature symptoms. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. Ricky Ott to continue this conversation. I hope that you'll be with us.